This book, Out of the Depths, which is Rabbi Lau's memoir of his of his experience surviving the Holocaust and building an extraordinary life, so much so that when President Ronald Reagan was introduced to Rabbi Lau and was told the story, I think it was by Rabbi Herschel Schacht, he warmly, with tears in his eyes, said, it's so good to meet a living legend. And so we have this opportunity tonight to converse for a little while with Rabbi Lau, indeed a living legend. And I wanted to begin by asking Rabbi Lau, you know, how does a child of 5 years old, from 5 to 8, survive Buchenwald? I think it's almost unprecedented. And if you could just tell us a little bit about how just the miracle after miracle and your brother's involvement, Naftali Lavi, in this kind of a story. We should remember that, I'm just going to interject, I said Naftali, Rabbi Lau's older brother, who was only 16 at the time, right? I think 16. He was driven by a mission that their father, Rabbi Moshe Lau, who was one of the great Torah giants of his time, gave him to make sure to save and protect Rabbi Lau, at that time Lulik, and maintain the chain, the rabbinic chain that goes now 39 generations with your son. How did it happen? How is it possible?
You have to read the book to know how it happened. But the secret is that even after reading the book and knowing it by heart, you don't have the real answer. Ben Gurion, when he came here for the first time as Prime Minister of Israel in 1949 to establish the UGA, he was asked in a television program here, Good Morning America, you are a secular man. Do you believe in miracles? The establishment of the Jewish state? He said, because I am a realist, I do believe in miracles. Our survival is a miracle. Even today I have met with my dear friend, he's here, Mr. Krakowski. We have met with Mr. Zborowski of the American Society for Yad Vashem. And the conclusion of the three was, only a miracle is the answer for our survival. Whatever you can tell, coincidence here and there, very interesting, such as telling you that the Lord Almighty have sent many messengers, like Elias the prophets, to save me, to protect me. Many. Naftali, my brother, he is the real hero of the story. He sacrificed his life thousands of times in order to fulfill the promise he gave our father to protect me and to take care, if it will be possible, if we will survive, that the chain of 1,000 years rabbinic dynasty will be unbroken. We have met on our way many angels, even that Czech physician in the entrance in Buchenwald. Everyone had to get an injection to prevent, to avoid all kinds of diseases entering to Buchenwald on January 45. There were many German staff of the Gestapo in Buchenwald at that time. They wanted to avoid all kinds of diseases we brought with us from Poland from 5.5 years of war, of ghettos and labor camps. And we stood one after the other, naked already, shaved already after the Basque law. And the doctor, who was himself a prisoner of war, a Czech, not a Jewish, a communist, he gave the injections arm to arm, but then all of a sudden he lost an arm. I was 7.5 years old, but in the height of 5 years, he didn't see me. He looked down and saw a child. How old are you? He asked me in German. My brother told me to answer, I'm 15. because Buchenwald was for men only. The children, together with the ladies, the mothers, the grandmothers, were sent to Bergen-Belsen for the final way. Buchenwald was for men. My brother brought me into Buchenwald, smuggled me in a sack because he knew it's for men only, so they will not shoot me on the spot in the entrance. Now when I am here in the line for the injection, I told him I'm 15. He said, I asked you how old you are. He said, I told you, 15. Who is this, your father? He said, no, he's my brother. How old is the child? And he told you, 15. Luki said to him, this portion, this size of injection in this body will kill him on the spot. I don't want to be his murderer. Tell me the truth, how old is the child? He said, 7.5. After eliminating half of the size, he gave me only a half portion. A Czech, a physician, a prisoner in Buchenwald, communist, I don't know his name. He was one of the messengers. But few days before, when we were in the train station, a few months before, on November 44, and we were sent from the ghetto to the train station because the Russian aircrafts came closer and closer, and the Germans were afraid that we would be liberated by the Russian. They pushed us to Germany, but in the station, they made a selection. Women and children on one side, men on the other. I went automatically with my mother. I was 7.5, less than 7.5. I went with my mother. Naftali, who is older, with 11 years, was 18. He stood on the other side with the man. My mother, in 1 second, with the dogs and with the sticks and with the bullets, is all this hell. She didn't lose her mind. She understood if the German have time to make a selection, means we are on the same train but not in the same wagons. We are not going to the same destiny. So who has a better chance to survive? The men. They are productive. They can work for the German efforts. At the second, the last second before we were pushed into the trains, she pushed me to my brother on the other side in the station. Tulek, she said, Naftali, take Lulek. My brother cried out, what shall I do as a child? He himself was a thin, skelet, a Muslim. He has to take care for a child. What to do? Take him. And she was pushed into the train. This was the last time we saw her. The fog of the locomotive. It was very cloudy, foggy. That's what I remember. November, Poland, Piotrków, Trybunalski. She pushed me to my brother. And this pushing me saved my life. She didn't survive in Ravensbrück. We survived in Buchenwald.
There was another angel, Fyodor. Maybe tell us a little about him.
In Buchenwald, as a Polish child, I was among Russian prisoners of war. One of them was a young boy, 18.5, Fyodor. He sacrificed his life to protect me, and till this very last moment, I don't have any explanation for that. Why did he do it? Not a Jew. From Rostov on the Don, he was kept in Dortmund in the street as a communist, whatever, and they put him in Buchenwald, in concentration camp. He used to steal daily potatoes from the German to cook for me a potato soup, warm soup daily, to protect my ears from freezing in the Appell, 3-4 hours standing there, with the order, Mitzen auf! Take off your hats. Under my hat was a wool on my ears that Fyodor did it for me. I looked after him. He wanted to take me with him after the war. My brother didn't permit. He wanted me to go together to Eretz Israel before the establishment of the Jewish state. And Fyodor said, you have no home. Your parents don't live anymore. The child will not have a home. Let him go with me. I take care. I have a family. My brother said, no. I looked after Fyodor many years. I asked even in the Kremlin in 1989, in the head of the Politburo at that time, Antishashvili, sitting on the chair of Stalin, I told him the story that a Russian young man saved my life. I want to meet him. Later on, Professor Kent Walcher from Michigan University made a research about Buchenwald in Bad Arolsen and archives in Germany 3 years ago. And he found a document from the Gestapo, beginning of 45. The Gestapo is looking after a Russian prisoner named Fyodor Mikhaelshchenko of Rostov at the Don. Why is he sacrificing himself to protect a Jewish child in Buchenwald called Lulek? This was the first time I have heard the last name Mikhaelshchenko. Professor Walters saw the name. The story was for him very full of curiosity. He asked in the archives in Buchenwald and the American Germany troops who was in block number 8, who is Lulek. So he made a press conference in Chicago on June 2008. I found the Russian man who saved the life of Chief Rabbi Lau. And on the radio, the Israeli radio, Naftali Menashe asked me on the telephone, the name Fyodor means something to you? I said, how do you know Fyodor? He saved my life. He told me the story of the press conference of Professor Walters. This is the preface to this English edition of my book. When I made the book in Hebrew, I didn't know the name of Fyodor, so I didn't tell it. Now we have discovered him, the whole story is here, and he passed away, unfortunately, in 1994. He told in a film in Buchenwald about me all the details, and his daughters came to Israel, were asked by Yad Vashem in Yerushalayim to receive a medal for their father, righteous among the nations, Fyodor.
In your book, especially in the English edition, you were very insistent about writing your history and your educational history when you came to Israel and some of the Torah luminaries who you interacted with. Amongst them were Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Shach, and I just want to, these are very different personalities. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was the Rosh Yeshiva of Kol Torah, very beloved. People might not know, but I think conceivably the largest funeral in Jewish history was his funeral, 300,000. And they came from all different venues. They tell a joke that there were two boys, each one with a kippah sugar, and one is telling the other, what are all the Haredim doing here? So, you know, and the other personalities, Rav Shach, much more stern. Just very briefly outline, you know, who they were and the influence and why you were so insistent that their story be in the book.
Both, they had one thing, except knowledge of Torah, as geniuses, both. They were more in personality than in their words. They gave an example, a personal example in their behavior. They were not just knowing a lot or speaking about. They were. Their behavior, their personality was a book of ethics for me, for my colleagues, for my generation. To speak about them, it's a long, long story. I will only remind one detail about Salman Auerbach, which is not in this book. He was very weak in his last year, 87 years old, but very weak. He had many addresses in Yerushalayim of elderly people, lonely people, and sick people. He used to go to visit them, to encourage them morally. And for them, that Reb Shlomo Zalman, the genius of Yerushalayim, came to visit me. This was more than a vitamin, more than all kinds of injections. And last year, Erev Rosh Hashanah, you have the longest slichot in the night of Schor Brit, one night before Rosh Hashanah. He didn't go to the shul anymore. He couldn't make it. One floor, he lived in the second floor, to go to the shul and go back was too weak to do it. In the morning, Erev Rosh Hashanah, after that night of Slichot, he disappeared from his room. His son, Borach, was looking, where is father? What happened to him? He couldn't move yesterday. After a few hours, Erev Rosh Hashanah, he came back from this trip, going on the fourth floor to an old man, sick and lonely, to visit him and to wish him a happy new year, Ktiva v'chatima tova. The son of Borah said, Dad, father, you are so sick, so weak, you couldn't go to the shul. And you went to this old man on the fourth floor with no elevator. He said, why don't you understand the difference? To go to the Slichot, this is between me and Ribbono Shel Olam. He, upstairs, knows very well how sick and weak I am. So he will forgive me. But the old one, he doesn't know. The old man thinks, will think, that I don't relate to him anymore.
I neglected him.
That I don't concern about him anymore. So I had to do to make him a happy new year. You understand, these are not just geniuses who wrote books and give brilliant lessons. They were personalities of ethics, of moral. I don't see in other institutions
disciplines
that a lecturer is also a guide for life, how to treat human beings, how to behave for the... When his wife passed away, he went to the levaya, to the funeral. At her grave, he said, Shlomo Zalman, there is a custom to ask forgiveness from someone who passed away. All the day, on my way to the cemetery, I think, for what do I have to ask you, my wife, forgiveness? We were together 60 years. I didn't find even one reason. I never spoke to you loudly. I never cursed, God forbid. I never did you any harm or damage. I don't know. But still, this is a custom. I will not be an exception. Please forgive me.
You know, I'll tell you a story you probably don't know, but a friend of mine drove Rav Shach to Shlomo Zalman's funeral. He was old in his own right at that time. He tells this fellow, he says, you know what? My funeral, there won't be such a big crowd. By mir nicht anders als Grace Levaya. Come, come, a minion. Maybe a minion. Ich bin zu quick with zu viel Menschen. I fought to argue with too many people. As chief rabbi, you intersected with many world leaders. Amongst them was Pope John Paul II, who you had a common one common dimension, namely in terms of the geography where you grew up. And there's this extraordinary story with Shachna Heller, if you could just share it with us.
I was invited to La Scala, the opera house, not to sing, but to be on a dais on a debate among leaders of the religions, monotheistic religions. How do you see peace in your outlook? What is your concept for peace? Carlo Maria Martini, the Cardinal of Milan, representing the Catholic Church. Prince Talal ibn Hussein, the brother of King Hussein, Hassan, representing the Islam. Me, representing Judaism. And the fourth one represented atheism, Mikhail Gorbachev. That time still president. It was on September 93. The Pope, John Paul, knew about this symposium. So he sent someone from San Egidio, Professor Serefico, Ambrogio Serefico, asking me to visit him. He wants to meet me. Later on, I have understood even why. It's personally touched. I said, I have no reason to go to the Vatican with all the sculptures, with all this. I have a problem. To go to the Vatican itself to save lives, pikuach nefesh, it's not only permitted, it's a commandment. But there is no pikuach nefesh for me to meet with the Pope. If we can meet some else, not in the Vatican, I will be more than happy to meet with him. It was on September. He waited in his summer house in Castel Gandolfo, a village 40 minutes drive from the Vatican. He will wait for me there. Even Gorbachev was there 2 days before me. He came also to the symposium, was invited to the Pope 2 days earlier. I came in, but before I went to Italy, it was already published in the newspapers that I'm going to meet with the Pope, Chief Rabbi of Israel, with the Pope, and both born in Poland. In Polish newspapers, you cannot imagine what an alarm it was. We contributed, Poland contributed, the two leaders of the two monotheistic religions. The two leaders, we, the Polacks. Me from Piotrków and he from Wadowice, near Krakow. And before I went, came to my home, Yaakov Bar-Or, let his memory be blessed, it's 18 years ago. And he brought me a book from Sir Martin Gilbert, the biograph of Winston Churchill, made a book called Holocaust, subtitle, The Jewish Tragedy. Page number 902, there is a small story. Bar-Or, who was one of the executors, Tovim, in the Eichmann process, together with Hausner and Terlo and Gabriel Bach, Yaakov Bar-Or. He brought me the story. I want you to know it. I read the story, was very touched. I came to the Pope. My second question was, if this story is true, what is the story? A young Jewish couple in Krakow, 1942. Heller, David and Helen, last name Heller, Hiller, had a child of 2 years old, Shachna. The German came to take them away. They didn't know if they go to Plaszów or to Auschwitz, both very close to Krakow. She was very friendly with a neighbor, a Catholic Polish woman by the name Jachowicz. Pana Jachowica, Mrs. Jachowicz, please protect my Shachna until we come back. We will return. I know that you will take care, you love him. Yes, of course. In age of four, that boy Shachne knew by heart all the songs and the psalms and the prayers of the Catholic Church in Poland. He used to go every Sunday with the Jachowiczes. He grew up as a Polish child. World War II ended, 1945. The child is 5 years old. The parents didn't return. Pana Jachowica, the lady, came with the child to the bishop of Krakow, Karol Wojtyla, asking him to baptize the child because he's their child. They want to adopt him legally. He understood that he's Jewish. He said, why now, in 5 years old? Said, the parents, Heller, gave him to me. Can you imagine, ask the cardinal, the bishop, what would be the reaction of his biologic parents to this step, baptizing the child? I have to speak to you frankly and honestly, my lord. I don't have to describe, no imagination. I do remember when Panna Helena, stood at the door. She made with the hand to me and to the boy and said to me, Pana Jachowica, in case that we will not return, please take care that Shachna will be brought up in Jewish arms. In that case, said the bishop, I will not baptize the child. That bishop is you, the Pope. Karol Wojtyla, that's your name. I want to know if the story is true. He looked at the ceiling. He smiled, was very happy that I know the story about him. This is not the only child I behaved like this. I never baptized Jewish children. By the way, Shachna Hiller is today, 38 years later, is today an observant Jew in Brooklyn, New York. He was following the footsteps of that child as a pope, 38 years. When I was once on Friday night in the home of Rabbi Raphael Grossman, the president of the RCA, former president, in Memphis, Tennessee. And I told this story about the Pope with Shachna Hiller. A young man stood up, said, wow, I am a student in Washington, D.C. I was born here and I live here in Memphis. I have known that Chief Rabbi Lau comes for Shabbat. I came from Washington to be with you this Shabbat, and you tell me a story about Shachna Hiller. The son of that Shachna Hiller is a student in Washington, D.C., and we share the same room in the dormitory of the university. By the way, he doesn't live in Brooklyn anymore. He moved to New Jersey. This is a story about a Jewish pope. The pope said to me, I remember your grandfather, Rabino Frankel Teomi, walking to the synagogue on Shabbat and surrounded with very many children. How many children did he have? The answer was 47, only from my mother's side. He asked how many survived Holocaust. The answer is 5. Then he looked again to the ceiling and said, I have visited between 100 to 120 states already. In each of them, I say and I do insist on the obligation of all mankind to promise the future and the continuity of our senior brother, the Jewish people.
Just by association, you had a very interesting conversation with Fidel Castro. He referred to you as the Jewish Pope. How did that conversation go?
Part of my family survived Europe by Cuba, and they came to the United States through Cuba, before Fidel Castro, of course, in the 40s, in the late 30s even, 39. Cuba, Castro is since 1959 there. I was invited to Venezuela, to Caracas, on behalf of Bar-Ilan University for a lecture tour. And the rabbi of Caracas at the time, Pinchas Brenner, was in my home to invite me to these 2 days lecturing in Caracas and asked me what will be my fee, what I demand. Said, I demand nothing in money, but you are very close to Cuba. My family partly was in Cuba. They immigrated to the United States. But I'm very curious to know, et achai ani mevakesh, like Yosef HaTzadik said, I am looking after my brothers. I'm sure there are some Jews in Cuba yet. There is no rabbi since 1959, and I speak now about February 94. I want to meet with them if you can arrange for me a visit to Cuba. He, Rabbi Brenner, was very close to the Cubanish ambassador in Venezuela. He have arranged with him a permission for me to come, not from the United States, but from Caracas, a small plane. There were two small planes. Other people joined me, so I will have a minion every day for 2 days in Cuba. And the second day, they came to me, someone asking me to go to meet with Comandante Fidel Castro. He wants to meet with you. That talk was over 3 hours. 5 minutes before 10 p.m., I came to his office. He joined me to the elevator. It was 1 o'clock a.m. exactly. And he said to me, 3 hours talk, I know everything about you, Gran Rabino. I know that your brother, who is the ambassador of Israel to New York, Consul General, Ambassador Lavi, smuggled you to the camp in a sack to protect you, carrying you on his shoulder for a long time. One thing I don't understand. A child of 8 years came to Palestine, didn't know the language, no father, no mother, no home, and instead of becoming a criminal in the street and homeless, you became the Jewish Pope. How come? I said to him the same question I was asked 2 years ago, 1992, by Yitzhak Rabin, 10 days before he was elected for the second time to be Prime Minister of Israel. He asked me the same question. How came that you became Chief Rabbi at that time of Tel Aviv, a child with no parents, no home, no education, no language, strange? When I mentioned the name of Rabin, he said, oh, he is a brave man. Because of the Oslo Agreement, he's a brave man. He's going to make peace with the Palestinian, brave man. He and Perez as well. He didn't say Perez, but Perez, like a Spanish pronunciation, Perez. I said to him, this was for me a good thing. There is no diplomatic relationships since 1959. We are now February 94. Can you show and express your appreciation to these two leaders somehow? Send with me something, a souvenir, a token of appreciation for those three leaders. He said, you are an empire. I am very poor. What can I send you? I said, I was told that they are very special Havana cigars. We don't produce cigars. He said, do they smoke? I said, look, Shimon Peres was by a psychologist in Italy who refrained him from smoking. Yitzhak Rabin is smoking Kent, American cigarettes, cigarettes, 3 packages a day. They don't have to smoke the cigars. They have to put it on the table in their office with a card in your name to know that you appreciate them. He said, if you will be so kind to carry it for them and for the mayor of Jerusalem, Tebi Kolek, as well, I will send you. He sent us 3 boxes that I could not to smuggle it with the airplane. And I went to the Bahamas, from the Bahamas to Miami, from Miami to Roma, from Roma to Tel Aviv, with these cigarettes.
How would it have looked if the Jewish Pope was arrested for smuggling? Had you been caught? I say, how would it looked if the Jewish Pope was arrested for smuggling? Because it's forbidden to bring Havana cigars into the United States. Or was it at least at that time? Of course, Yitzhak Rabin was a notorious smoker. When he was prime minister, he was also the minister of health. And he realized the quandary. There was a law passed in the Knesset forbidding smoking in public. He said, how can I possibly sign this? I would be such a hypocrite. But
I don't want to spoil his people here, but Shimon Peres used to smoke till the age of 75. He is now 88, thanks God.
I wanted to ask you a question about Yom HaShoah, the day of commemoration for the Holocaust, which was established by the Knesset. And the day which was established by the Knesset in Chodesh Nisan was because it was the day of the Warsaw, beginning of the Warsaw Rebellion. But there are those, Rabbi Soloveitchik, was very much opposed to Yom HaShoah. And he argued that the proper day for Yom HaShoah to commemorate the Churban, the destruction of Europe, European Jewry, was Tisha B'Av, which is the day of mourning for all of Jewish tragedy. And I heard this once from Rabbi Soloveitchik. He said that when Menachem Begin, as prime minister, came to the United States, he met with him, and Begin, of his own initiative, said, I really want to change it. It belongs on Tisha B'Av. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, I've always been advocating that. The Rav told me that when Begin came back to Israel and promoted the idea, which was unsuccessful, he said there were articles and editorials in the Israeli papers criticizing Rabbi. He said, what is an American rabbi determining policy for the Knesset? And Yehuda Avner, interestingly, tells this episode in his book, The Prime Ministers. But I think underlying this question is an important philosophical question, is how do we view the Holocaust? Is it sui generis, unique, separate from Jewish history? Or do we see it as part of the sad part of Jewish history? After all, in the Churban HaBayis, some historians claim that 1/3 of the Jewish population was destroyed, about a million people. So how do you view it in terms of the perspective of how does one view the Holocaust?
There is a theoretic question, philosophy question, and historic one, as you describe it. And there's a practical and real problem here. And this is the real answer. I was asked that time when Menachem Begin offered to remove Day of Holocaust to Tisha B'Av. He didn't make it as a decision, just as an idea. He wanted to know what will be the reactions of people involved. I was asked in all kinds of media that time, and I said, no. The idea is good, but I am afraid. Unfortunately, Tisha B'Av is not enough known and preserved in our society. The religious, yeah. The non-religious, unfortunately, in the secular crisis, they don't fast on Tisha B'Av. Even some of the coffee houses or some restaurants are open on Tisha B'Av, and Yom HaShoah they are closed. The main reason is very simple one. Tisha B'Av is always in the vacation, in the summer vacation of 10 weeks vacation. So the teachers have no opportunity to teach about Tisha B'Av the children. Education starts not in age of 18, but 20 years before the child is born. Education starts to the parents of the children. When will they know about Tisha B'Av? When they go on a vacation in the 20th of June, elementary school in the 30th of June, and Tisha B'Av is somewhere mid of July or beginning of August usually. So they don't know about Tisha B'Av. You want that the destiny of Yom HaShoah will be the same? So the day of remembrance of the soldiers of IDF and the underground movements is in Dalet Iyar, a day before the Independence Day. Everyone respects in Israel this day, Dalet Iyar, Yom HaZikaron, the day of remembrance from our 22,000 heroes who fell on the very existence and survival of the state of Israel. And Yom HaShoah is connected with Ghetto Varsha. This wasn't the last day of the ghetto and not the first day of the mutiny. It was the hardest day of battles of the Gestapo, the German force, the Wehrmacht, and the Luftwaffe against the very few heroes in the Warsaw ghetto. Because it was that time, Kav Zayin Nissan was April 19. Hitler was born April 20. General Stroop, the ruler of Warsaw, wanted to bring a gift to the Führer, the ghetto, the destruction of the ghetto. So one day before his birthday, he wanted to destroy the ghetto and to liquidate the last fighters. He failed. They didn't succeed. So 19 April is in the history of World War II, the day of the hardest battlefield against the Jews there in Ghetto Warsaw. And the Knesset had decided it is a day remembrance for Shoah. If they would make it in Tisha B'Av, I'm afraid that not all the Israelis would remember what happened 70 years ago.
Part of your responsibilities as chief rabbi, well before that, was your extraordinary pastoral responsibilities. And I think you were inspired in that by your father-in-law, who was your predecessor, Rabbi Frankel, chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. One of the families that you speak about, and that is a family that ultimately you were the one, the Masada Kedushin for them. You officiated at their wedding, indeed at their parents' wedding. And this family was, almost the entire family was killed in the Sabaro bombing, terrorist bombing. A few weeks ago, Israel brought back Gilad Shalit. It was a very difficult decision, the trade, over 1,000 terrorists. The lone survivor of that son of that family protested that deal. Many have been questioned, was it a wise decision? I ask you both as a halachic question and in terms of policy, is how do we evaluate these kinds of trades, and how do we understand the actions of this lone survivor of the family in his very dramatic, unfortunate protest? He defaced the Rabin Memorial in the Rabin Square.
The Scheves Churder, that's the name of the family, because the father of the family, Moti Scheves Churder, was an Olech Hadash. He came from Holland with this Dutch name. He married a girl, Tzira Friedman, from Netanya. And I was the rabbi to officiate the wedding of this beautiful couple. They had 8 children, 3 boys who were in the army 10 years ago on summer, and the other 5, the younger, including a baby of 3 years, were taken by the parents to the Sbarro restaurant, Jaffa Corner, King George, the heart of Jerusalem, for lunch. It was the vacation of the summer, August. And that suicide bomber came in, said, Allahu Akbar, the Lord is great, killed himself, killed five of this family, three children and the parents. One injured girl of 16 years old from Melbourne, a tourist, was laying in the Shaare Tzedek Hospital. I used as chief rabbi to go to every injured in that intifada time, in all the hospitals to visit them, and all the funerals, and all the mourning to comfort the mourners and the shiva. I have heard from that girl day after that there was a table surrounded five children with a couple of the parents, and when the fire was in the restaurant and she was hardly injured, she remembers the last words that the father of that family, Motis Chevisko, she didn't know him, said to his children, kids, say with me, Shema Yisrael. And then she fainted. She lost consciousness, this girl from Melbourne, Australia. That Motis Cheves Choda, a beautiful man. Two girls were hardly injured, Leah and Chaya, 10 years old and 8 years old, both in the Bikur Horim Hospital. I know the family very well. One of the three boys, Meir, I officiated his wedding after that disaster. I understand them very well. The girl, the terrorist girl of Hamas, who brought the bomber suicide to this Sbarro restaurant to kill innocent people, more as possible, she brought them. She is one of the deal which was liberated now because of liberating Gilad Shalit. He couldn't bear it. That young boy, his parents, three of his brothers, children of 3 years old, and she has to go on to be liberated. I understand them. But on the other hand, we are a nation that doesn't speak in ABC but Aleph Bet in Hebrew. The initials of Aleph Bet are Ein Breira, no choice, no alternative. I followed the Shalit family from the very first day, 5 years and 4 months. They came to my office over 5 years ago to arrange for them a meeting with the Pope of today, Benedictus XVI, Ratzinger. They believed naively that he will apply to the authorities so the child will be liberated. He met them, the Goldwasser, Regev, and Shalit, the three families of the three kidnapped Israeli soldiers at that time of the Lebanese Second War. But he didn't succeed. I followed this family all the time. What can you expect? A father, Tzvi Shalit, the grandfather of Gilad, 83, 84 years old, lost a son in the Yom Kippur War, Yoel Shalit. Now his grandson is over 5 years in prison by the terrorists in Gaza, Hamas. He wants to brace his grandchild before he will close his eyes. What for an alternative Prime Minister Netanyahu and the government had? You see, in the vote in the government, three were opposing the deal, but 26 members of the cabinet were pro for that deal. We had no choice. When I entered to Buchenwald to close the cycle, there is something one sentence in metal letters in the gate. You can see it till this very last day. The city of Weimar, northeast Germany. In the suburb of Weimar, you find the concentration camp Buchenwald. The gate is still there. The crematoria is still there. The torture rooms are still there. All the barracks liquidated. There is a sentence I didn't know to read or to write till age of 8. So when I came, went out of the sack, waiting for the claw bars, I asked my brother Tulek, what is written here? In Auschwitz is written, Arbeit macht frei. Work liberates. What is here? He said, the translation, he said it to me in Polish, everyone to his destiny. It means we don't take care for you. We are not responsible. We cannot permit in the Jewish family this slogan, everyone to his destiny. We are responsible one for the other. Please remember Yehuda, son of Jacob. He said, I am ready to be here a slave for you, Joseph. He didn't know it's his brother, the ruler of Egypt. Let my younger boy, Benjamin, go home together with his brothers to our old father. I will replace him. I will be your slave, an eternal slave. Let him go. I'm the gerent, the responsible. I took it on my shoulders. Let him go. We are responsible. We had no choice. We have to be ready not to be kidnapped anymore. We have to take care, to be aware. The disaster wasn't by liberating 1,000 terrorists. The disaster was 5.5 years ago when Gilad Shalit fell in the arms of the Hamas. This was the mistake, this was the failure, and we have to pay.
One of the questions we have from our audience is, what's the biggest difference between being chief rabbi of Tel Aviv and the chief rabbi of Israel?
I will tell you something I was told from my father-in-law, later Frankel, chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, from you, Rabbi, Rabbi Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik. Let his memory be blessed forever. He was a candidate for chief rabbi in Tel Aviv in 1936. Rav Amiel was elected from Antwerp. Rav Herzog from Dublin, Ireland, and Rav Soloveitchik from Boston, New York, was not elected, were not elected. 1959, Rabbi Herzog passed away as chief rabbi of Israel. The first chief rabbi of the state of Israel passed away. Ben-Gurion, the prime minister, sent over the interior minister, the leader of the National Religious Party, that time Mizrahi, Poel Mizrahi, Moshe Shapira, sent him to Boston to offer Rav Soloveitchik the chair of chief rabbi of Israel, Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, to replace Rav Herzog. And if the Labor Party of Ben-Gurion and the National Religious Party of Shapira cooperate, there will be no other candidates. They have the majority. Shas didn't exist at that time. And the Likud was not against, was not a Likud, it was Tnuat HaCherut, Menachem Begin, he wasn't opposing it. So everyone will agree upon the candidate Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Gaon. Moshe Shapira came to Rav Soloveitchik. Immediately he said, no. He said, what means no? No, it means no. He said, may I dare to ask you, he was also a Litvak from Grodno, Shapira was from Grodno, the city of Reb Shimon Shkopsky Yeshiva. He said, for Tel Aviv, you were a candidate. You came to visit in Israel. You gave some lectures in Tel Aviv, in the great synagogue, in Moshe Skirim, the nursing home synagogue, Allenby 89. And here we offer you on a tatz of gold with no competition to be the chief rabbi of Israel. He said, why don't you understand? A rabbi of a city has a community, has balebatim, has people. Chief rabbi of Israel is an office, only representative. I am not to represent. I am not in a window. I know what means a rov. A rov is a rov of a city, a town, Marad de Atra. This I know from Varsha, from Brisk, from Vilna, and from here. So to be chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he wanted. To be chief rabbi of Israel, he refused. I was both. And I will tell you, by the way, chief rabbi of Israel is half chief rabbi, because there is Ashkenazi and Sfaradi. In Tel Aviv, I'm the only one.
You know, you tell the story in the book so poignantly about your father-in-law, how when there was a fire in his neighborhood, which was not so rare, the place of refuge that people came, where all the people came into his house to find just a place to be safe. So it reminded me, you quoted Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that when his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, became the rabbi, I think it was of Resein and then later Chaslavich. So his father, the great Rav Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk, told him, he said that the job of the Rav, he said that the job of the Rav is to do chesed, to do kindness to his constituency, to his people, which you've done on an international level, not just for the people, but for the people of Israel, even diplomatically negotiating on their behalf when meeting with world leaders. He said that Rav Meir Berlin asked, this the Rav talking, he said he asked different rabbonim, different great figures of his time, what indeed is the job of the Rav? So he said he asked Rav Rafal Shapira, the Netziv's son-in-law, what is the job of a Rav? And Rav Rafal, in his usual fashion, said, I really don't know. I've actually been wondering about it for a long time. And then he asked the Orach HaShulchan of Epstein, and he said that the job, who was a great codifier of Jewish, he said the job of the Rav is to answer queries in halacha, to paskin shilas. And Rav Meir Berlin said, and I asked Rav Chaim, and Rav Chaim said the job of the Rav is to do chesed. And the Rav said that on the Rav Chaim's kever, on his tombstone in Warsaw, the children decided that they would write Rav Chaim Brisker without all the titles, Ish HaChesed, Rav Chesed. That position can be fulfilled in both leadership positions. As Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv, as the model was your father-in-law that you speak about, and Chief Rabbi of Israel as well.
As Chief Rabbi in Israel, as I told you, I used to go to all the families who lost their dearest in the bloodshed of the Intifada, hundreds, about 1,000 people, 1,000 victims. All the hospitals from the south, Soroka in Be'er Sheva, to the north, Ha'emek in Afula. There was no one section in an hospital I didn't know by heart already. This is a very difficult job to do, to see the wounds, the bloodshed, babies torn into pieces, lack of organs, Yom Kippur War. I was 3 months devoted to the Ichilov Hospital, which that time wasn't a civilian hospital in Tel Aviv, but only for the army soldiers. The most difficult injured from the Suez Canal, from Sinai Desert, brought by helicopters to Sdeidov in Tel Aviv. Ichilov, there were 475 injured soldiers, burned in the tanks. New skin. Oh. The screamings, 3 months, day and night, is unforgettable. If you speak about Chesed, I served that time as the Rav, voluntarily, of that hospital. I was a district rabbi in North Tel Aviv that time, before being chief rabbi of Netanya. It was on 1973, beginning 1974. 3 months, I gave a lot of encouragement, not only to the soldiers, the wounded soldiers, but mainly to their parents, to the brothers, sisters, wives, and children. A rabbi can do a lot of chesed. Chesed is not only to offer money, tzedakah, charity, to offer yourself, to give yourself. Days and nights, to give your heart, to give your ear. Isaiah the prophet in chapter 49, Memtet, says one phrase after the other. The first is, Hashem Elokim Natan Li Leshon Limudim. The Lord Almighty gave me a good tongue, a learned tongue. How to explain, how to give a lesson, how to give a speech, how to give a drasha, leshon limudim. But one praise after, Hashem Elokim natan li ozen lishmua. The Lord Almighty gave me an ear to listen. A rabbi is a combination of both, to teach, to guide, to have students, to attract people to the Torah, to bring them closer to the Torah, but also a rabbi has to have an ear to listen. Sometimes the all assistance which is asked from you is just listening. Pay attention. You can't do anything, but you can listen to him. And this is for him the greatest aid he needs at the time. The combination of chesed and psak halacha, no conflict between them.
One of, undoubtedly, as you know, associated with Ichalav, one of your most poignant and painful experiences there was undoubtedly the day Yitzhak Rabin was shot and died at Ichalav. You, together with Shimon Peres, had to tell Leah Rabin about the terrible loss.
Yeah, Martin Indyk was that time together with us, the American ambassador to Israel. It was in the basement of Ichilov Hospital, 02-2. They tried to bring him back to life. They failed. There were three professors. When they came out from the operations room, we were waiting with Leah Rabin. Shimon Peres was the deputy of Yitzhak Rabin at the time, Minister of Foreign Affairs, and many others. They came out, they couldn't say that he died. All the three made with their heads from right to left. Means no chance, no way. Martin Indyk held the cellular, speaking to President Clinton, telling him what's going.
To his chaver.
He was the chaver, a good friend, Rabin. Shimon Peres came to me as chief rabbi, and the only rabbi at that time in the hospital, we were very close with Rabin. Peres came to me and said, what is the latest hour tomorrow, Sunday, to make the funeral in Yerushalayim, in Mount Herzl? I said, this is not a funeral of a private man. It's a funeral of a leader, of a nation, of a country, and it is an international loss. In his honor, which is our honor, we may postpone the funeral to Monday. Shimon Peres applied to Martin Indyk and said to him, Chief Rabbi Lau says that the funeral will be not tomorrow, but day after tomorrow, Monday. In a second, Martin Indyk said to us both, President Clinton will attend the Levaya, will participate. Because if it is tomorrow, he will not come. He cannot. 7 hours difference. And it was on November 5th. The day is short. To make it daytime till 5 o'clock, now is already 2 a.m. after midnight. He cannot come. On Monday, President will come. He came, President Mubarak came, Prince Charles came, King Hussein came, all the leaders from all the world came. This was a very famous speech, funeral speech of Clinton. Shalom Haveri spoke about binding of Isaac. Akedat Yitzhak, it was the same week parasha. The portion of that week was Vayera, Akedat Yitzhak, where the sentence is the name of my Hebrew audition, Al Tishlach Yadcha El Anar. But at that time, the angel didn't say, Al Tishlach Yadcha El Anar. And Yigal Amir killed, assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. Rabin tried to be a bridge between the religious and the secular. 3 bullets almost collapsed that bridge.
At your son's bar mitzvah, you quoted the pasuk by Amalek, Melchama l'Hashem b'Amalek midor dor, the battle and war against Amalek goes from generation to generation. And you explained it, midor dor, in us, how are we victorious over Amalek? It's midor dor from generation to, that we continue the tradition from generation to generation. That's really what your whole life has been about.
This is the last paragraph in my book, what you mentioned now. I end the book with this speech. It was the bar mitzvah of our oldest son. His name is Moshe Chaim, exactly the name of my late father, was the rabbi of Piotrkov, before Prussia, before the Shots, and perished in Treblinka in the age of 50. Moshe Chaim Lau, and here I have a son, Moshe Chaim Lau. At his bar mitzvah came all the leadership of the rabbis, including, of course, the chief rabbis of Israel of the time, Rav Ovadia Yosef and Rav Shlomo Goren, my father-in-law, Rav Frenkel, my uncle, Rav Fogelman, who brought me up, instead my father. And this was the Shabbat of Beshalach, split of Yamsuf, the Red Sea. And the war with Amalek is the end of this parasha. I didn't think that I will speak in the synagogue on Shabbat in that particular bar mitzvah of my son, because they were so senior rabbis. But people there in shul, they didn't give up. They said, we have heard all this drashot, but your son deserves at least what every usual bar mitzvah deserves here in this shul every Shabbat. You give a lecture for a bar mitzvah because it's your son, he has to lose it. Say something. I took the last sentence of the parasha. Milchama l'Hashem b'Amalek. Usually the simple explanation is the war of the Almighty against Amalek is eternal, midor dor, from one generation to the other. I said to my son, look, when you stand here at the Ark after reading the Torah and the Haftorah and carrying the name of my father who perished in the Holocaust and you were born already here in Israel, you fulfill another explanation of this pasuk, of this sentence. Milchama LaHashem ba'Amalek, the spiritual war against Amalek is midor dor, the transfer from one generation to the other, the transmit. If one generation will transmit the heritage, the Jewish heritage, to the next generation, this is the victory, this is our triumph, this is our revenge, this is the spiritual war against Amalek. If you will follow the footsteps of your grandfather, whose name you carry, and you will give it the honor, this will be the real victory against Amalek. Thanks God, he is a great rabbi.
Maybe we can just go for a few more minutes and then we'll conclude. You know, just in terms of that model, you were critical of, you know, a lot of Jews took nachas, I put it in quotes, but somehow ironically, that Cardinal Lustiger, the Archbishop of Paris, who was a Holocaust survivor, his parents were killed in the Holocaust, rose to such a high position in the Catholic Church. And he would sometimes don a regular suit and go into a shul to say Kaddish for his parents. Is he a model that we can take, at least in that segment of it, some nachas? I think you thought very much the opposite. He was also, you know, when he was considered a candidate, who was one on the list of potential candidates for the papacy. Of course, anybody who's listed as a candidate for the papacy never wins, unless he's the Jewish pope.
He was once invited to Israel, to Tel Aviv, when I was chief rabbi, and I went, as everyone went, all the leaders of the state went every Yom HaShoah to the main commemoration event in Yad Vashem in Yerushalayim. And the same day, the same time, 8 p.m., he was invited to give a lecture in Tel Aviv University about Holocaust. I was invited to be on a debate with him. I said to the president of the university that time, Professor Dinstein, Svetzer, Yoram, not only that I will not participate, I belong to Yad Vashem. I will be there with the president of the state, with the prime minister, with the chief of staff, with all the leaders of the country, president of the Supreme Court. I will not show my back to them to go to your university, especially that I oppose the disappearance of Cardinal Lustiger for the Israeli students in the university. He is not the right model. He is not the right example to conclude what happened in Holocaust. When he was 16, he entered, he wasn't in the Holocaust. His mother perished in Auschwitz. He was in France, hidden with his father. He went in a Catholic church in Lyon and converted to Catholicism, to Christianity. If we take this as an example for the Israeli, the Jewish students, Hitler made 6 million reasons to say Kaddish. The way of Lustiger will prevent the chance for someone to say Kaddish in the future. Because as a Catholic leader, he has no family, he's not married, he has no children, no family. Is this the muster, the model we want to adapt, we want to show to to our students that no one will be in the future to say Kaddish for not only the victims of Holocaust, for their parents. I oppose this way. This is an escape way. We need to be united. We need to exist. And we have to follow the footsteps of the victims. Because the Nazis didn't declare a war only against Jews, but also against Judaism. As an evident, look, the first real pogrom they made before World War II broke out was the Kristallnacht, November 9th, next week, 1938. Against whom was the Kristallnacht? Against the synagogues, the schools in Germany. Thousand and a hundred synagogues were burned and destroyed in the same night. It was systematically arranged very well, as they knew to arrange things. Over 1,100 synagogues burned to show what is the target of Nazism, Judaism. We have to show that we have the victory and not them. In order that you give your back to the Jewish tradition, you betrayed your heritage and your people. You complete their work. They wanted to liquidate us as a Jewish people, a Jewish nation. So how can we live together with such a behavior? He, I must tell you, Lustiger, he knew that I opposed him because it was printed in all the newspapers in Israel at that time. We have met at the 60th anniversary of liberation from Auschwitz in Krakow and in Auschwitz. He shook my hand. We became friends. And here in New York, in the West Side, there is the Jewish Heritage Museum. It was a symposium. In the Hebrew edition of my book, you can see a picture. I speak on behalf of the World Jewish Congress. On my left side, listening to me, Cardinal Lustiger from Paris. On my right side, listening to me, Cardinal Schönbrunn of Vienna. We went back to the hotel, to the same hotel. And I said to Lustiger, I'm going now back home to Tel Aviv. I'm going to Kennedy Airport. And he went a day later back to France. I felt pity for him. He's going back to four walls. No family, nothing. I go back to my national home, Israel, and to my family, children and grandchildren. Whom does he have? He's a lonely man. He stood at the door, the gate of the hotel, I will never forget here, 42nd Street, the Hyatt, Grand Hyatt, shook my hand. This was our separation, he said. All of a sudden, Yiddish. Sei gesund und stark. Be healthy and strong. I try to do so.